Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at Brazil's unending flood. One of its richest cities, Porto Alegre, is still struggling with floodwaters that rushed in more than a month ago. It's been a national shock. Officials are still looking for bodies and warning of the spread of disease. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jaleel, and at 14 hours GMT on Monday the 10th of June, these are our main stories. The far right have made gains in the European elections, but the EU Commission chief insists the centre is solid. We look at the results from across Europe. The BBC speaks to the widow of the IS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi about the persecution of Yazidis in Iraq as they try to claim compensation from her.
At the time, I felt ashamed. How is it that women could be degraded to such an extent? I was entirely against it, but I was a helpless woman.
Also in this podcast,
people are being expelled from schools. Some people are being rejected by own family members simply because of who we are.
The South African photographer who's won international acclaim for challenging discrimination. We begin with the fallout from the European elections. The EU Parliament has seen an overall swing to the right. Centre-right parties strengthened their majority, winning in Germany, Greece, Poland and Spain. The European Commission chief, Ursula von der Leyen, said this showed that the centre was solid.
The centre is holding. But it is also true that the extremes on the left and on the right have gained support. And this is why the result comes with great responsibility for the parties in the centre.
But the far right triumphed in several countries, including France. President Macron called snap parliamentary elections after his party was trounced by the populist anti-immigrant national rally of his longtime rival, Marine Le Pen. Hugh Schofield is our Paris correspondent.
A leap into the unknown is how the French media is describing President Macron's bolt from the blue. Many are asking how he could have decided on such a risky endeavour as to dissolve Parliament when it's obvious the national rally is riding high. If it can repeat its triumph at the Europeans, then the prospect of a hard right government sharing power with President Macron is very real. His calculation seems to be that voters will come back to the mainstream when they're choosing their own MPs, and that Marine Le Pen's party will ultimately be unable to form a majority. But he can't be sure of that. It's equally possible that the voters, having delivered one punch to the president, simply back it up with another.
Hugh Schofield. Well, the impact of President Macron's decision has been felt in the country's economic sector, with the euro dropping in value against the dollar and falls on French markets. Theo Leggett reports.
Analysts say there are fears that if he loses, a potentially difficult cohabitation between the president and a prime minister representing his political opponents could undermine efforts to reform the public finances and bring down the budget deficit. The result has been a spike in the implied cost of government borrowing. That, in turn, has hit shares in major banks, with BNP Paribas falling more than 5% and Société Générale losing 7%. The uncertainty has also weighed on the value of the euro, which fell to a one-month low against the US dollar.
Theo Leggett. But the far right didn't do so well in Eastern Europe. Hungary's ruling party, led by Viktor Orban, got its worst result in decades. Bulgaria saw an abysmally low turnout for all parties, and the pro-EU Prime Minister of Poland, Donald Tusk, managed to beat a populist anti-immigrant party that had ruled Poland until last year. In Hungary, the real winner of the night was a former ally of Mr. Orban's turned political foe. Our reporter in Budapest, Nick Thorpe, told us more.
Viktor Orban and his Fidesz party did come first, But they lost 1 million votes compared to 2 years ago, the last parliamentary elections. And out of the blue, effectively, Peter Madjar, a former Fidesz insider, a lawyer, a former diplomat, set up a party 3 months ago, broke from Fidesz and has been sharply criticising them across the country. He won an astonishing 30% of the vote yesterday and has really taken over as the main challenger to Viktor Orban and to Fidesz.
So showing that Viktor Orban is no longer invincible.
That's right. And I think this was important because the European Parliament this year was going to be very important for Viktor Orban. He's seen generally as a right-wing, a far-right leader, and he was very much seeing himself as an ally of Giorgia Meloni in Italy, of Marine Le Pen in France. And suddenly, though, just at this moment when he thought he was going to be extremely influential in Europe, he has seen in this result the carpet, as it were, being pulled out from under his feet. So even though his party did best, they're in pretty big trouble here in Hungary.
And in Bulgaria, where there are parliamentary elections as well as a European vote, incredibly low turnout.
Incredibly low turnout, but this is really because Bulgaria, people are exhausted. This was the sixth parliamentary election in just 3 years. And those leading parties there, GEB, the centre-right party, which actually came first again in this election, they have shown themselves unwilling or unable to collaborate with the other main parties on the stage there. So there's this sort of constant political stalemate in Bulgaria. And one has the impression that the people of Bulgaria are sort of fed up with voting and fed up with their politicians for failing to come out with a workable government.
And a very different picture in Poland, where the party of the pro-European Union Prime Minister Donald Tusk did well.
That's right. The Civic Coalition, they won 20 seats in the European Parliament to the right-wing Law and Justice Party, which won also 20 seats. That's actually the first time that Donald Tusk's Civic Coalition have actually beaten Law and Justice. But there, then, a good result for the centre-right and for Donald Tusk in Poland, which is, I think, one of the reasons why some in Europe are saying that the centre held on the day, because Poland, obviously a very influential country, the most influential of the East Europeans.
Nick Thorpe, and later in this podcast, we'll have some more analysis on why voters backed far-right parties in such large numbers. 8 months into Israel's war in Gaza, there is no end in sight. That prompted the former defence minister and military chief, Benny Gantz, to resign on Sunday from Israel's war cabinet, which was formed in the aftermath of the Hamas attacks on October the 7th. He accused the Israeli prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, of being more concerned about his political survival than the return of the hostages being held in Gaza. The turmoil in Israeli politics comes as international anger is growing over the huge scale of Palestinian casualties, with the US also voicing concern. Its top diplomat, Antony Blinken, is back in the region for his eighth Middle East tour since the war began. So how damaging is Benny Gantz's resignation for the Israeli prime minister, and what does it mean for his war cabinet? Our correspondent in Jerusalem is John Donison.
This is significant, but it's not going to bring down Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government for the moment. It's significant because Benny Gantz was a relatively moderate voice. He was someone with enormous military experience, and he was someone in particular who I think the Americans had a lot of respect for. And given that relations between Mr. Netanyahu and the Americans are so bad at the moment, it was someone who the Americans felt they could talk to. That moderate voice has now gone. I think the fear amongst Mr. Netanyahu's critics is that it could leave the way for more extremist elements in the government, and in particular Itamar Ben-Gvir, the security minister, to have a greater say. And indeed, he has said he should replace Mr. Gantz inside that war cabinet.
And Mr. Gantz, when he announced his resignation, he was very clear that the US was not involved in this decision. But we now have Antony Blinken visiting the Middle East again the following day. What are we expecting from this latest visit by the US Secretary of State?
Well, Mr. Blinken is going to be putting pressure on both sides, both Hamas and the Israeli government, to accept this ceasefire plan. Now, when it was announced, announced by Joe Biden, it was called an Israeli plan, and Prime Minister Netanyahu has suggested he will go along with it, even if reluctantly. He said it was far from perfect. But as I say, there are people within the government on the extreme right who have said they will pull out if any sort of ceasefire plan is accepted for Gaza, and that would be something that would bring the government down. So it's something that Mr. Netanyahu has a difficult calculation to make.
John Donison in Jerusalem. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi led a terrorist group which 10 years ago seized large areas of Iraq and Syria. He called the group Islamic State and claimed to be a caliph, a claim almost universally rejected by Muslims everywhere. During his reign of terror in Iraq, thousands of members of a long-persecuted minority called the Yazidis were killed or tortured. Many Yazidi women and girls were kidnapped and forced to become sex slaves. Some survivors are attempting to sue the widow of the IS leader, Hudayfa. She is accused of sex trafficking. Faraz Kilani of the BBC Arabic service has this report.
10 years ago, thousands of Yazidis fled across northern Iraq, persecuted by the Islamic State. Many were killed, and more were kidnapped and taken as sex slaves. Saad was one of them. 10 years on, we returned to the family home from where she was abducted by IS fighters.
There's no one left from my family. Only me and my brother survived.
At the age of 14, she was taken captive and suffered years of sexual abuse. Saad's sister and her uncle Hamid's daughter are still missing. Now, they are determined to fight for justice, for what happened to her and the family. The girls were kept at the home of IS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. It's believed they were then sold as sex slaves. We went to meet al-Baghdadi's widow, Hudayfa. We are now being allowed into this prison in the Iraqi capital. She has been held here for a few months on terrorism-related crimes. Saad is taking her to court for her alleged part in their ordeal. She admits the two missing girls did stay at her home.
At the time, I felt ashamed. How is it that women could be degraded to such an extent? I was entirely against it, but I was a helpless woman.
Saad insists that Hudayfa is not innocent, and she must be confronted with her crimes.
It's al-Baghdadi's wife. She's a criminal like him. Where is my family? I can't find them. Isn't it because of both of al-Baghdadi and his wife? I won't forgive her. I will take my and other Yazidis girls' revenge.
I asked Hudayfa why she didn't help the girls escape.
I myself couldn't leave. How was I supposed to help her? I don't deny that my husband was a criminal. I'm very sorry about what they went through, but I wish they would know that I had absolutely nothing to do with this.
Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi led IS, an extremist jihadist group. This brutal organization carried out crimes, including murder, torture, kidnapping, and enslavement. He was killed in a U.S. raid in 2019. Hudayfa says her husband was changed forever during detention at a U.S.-run prison in 2004.
I've always asked him about that change in his mental state, and he used to tell me that he was exposed to something I could not understand. I believe that he was subjected to sexual torture during his detention.
The Pentagon didn't reply to a request for a comment on her claims. Al-Baghdadi's death didn't end the Yazidis' search for justice. For many, the trauma continues. Thousands are still missing. But Saad and her family could be heading towards justice and finally have someone who may be held accountable.
That report by Faraz Kilani. In April, the Nigerian film star Junior Pope was killed on his way back from a film set when the boat he was travelling in capsized. In the aftermath of his death, Hannah Gelbart from the BBC's What in the World podcast has been speaking to actors and producers in Lagos about the safety record of the Nigerian film industry, known as Nollywood, and whether something needs to change.
This is from a video recorded by the Nollywood actor Junior Pope the day before he died. He's on a boat, travelling fast, and he's not wearing a life jacket.
See the risk we take, people, to entertain you.
The very next day, on his way back from a film set in Anambra, Nigeria, the boat he was on capsized, killing him and four other people. A safety investigation found multiple failures. The boat wasn't registered, its driver had no license, and only one passenger was wearing a life jacket. That's because they'd brought it on board themselves. But in a now-deleted Instagram video, the producer of the film said she was told there were life jackets and Junior Pope was offered one but didn't take it. Actress and screenwriter Ruth Kadiri was a friend of Pope's and she was shocked by his passing.
It was much more painful for me because I have been in that exact situation before. So I understood the fear, everything he must have felt at the last minute of his life.
Ruth had also been involved in a boat accident whilst making a movie, and she can't swim.
I asked everybody, the team, if everything was okay. They said yes, the canoe was fine. So I got on the boat, action, they said, and then they started to paddle. The canoe just tumbled into this very big river.
She was saved by a colleague who grabbed her in the water. Now she's calling for change.
I think there should be additional safety regulatory body that is included to production sets. The director is thinking about creating the content. The actor is thinking about getting in character. So let us also just create an extra body. Probably it's not going to cost so much and it might just end up saving you a lot of stress.
The Actors Guild of Nigeria posted a statement after Junior Pope's death, saying it set up a special committee to look into improving safety guidelines and protocols. Nollywood actor Chidi Dike says he has seen signs of improvement since the boat crash.
Safety records has been quite low, but right now it's better. So I think the incident was a bit of a wake-up call to everybody, producers, directors, actors. Right now we actors, like, we know that, oh, we have to go back home on time, come on now. Lives are important too.
Nollywood is the third largest film industry in the world, after Hollywood and India's Bollywood, and it publishes more than 2,500 films a year. But this tragic incident has turned attention from what's happening in front of the camera to some of the work practices going on behind it.
Hannah Gelbart. Still to come in this podcast.
When we do surgery and we shine a special camera, we can see the cancer cells light up during surgery with white light.
We hear how a fluorescent dye is helping scientists to tackle cancer.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at Brazil's unending flood. One of its richest cities, Porto Alegre, is still struggling with floodwaters that rushed in more than a month ago. It's been a national shock. Officials are still looking for bodies and warning of the spread of disease. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast. Japan has an age problem. Nearly 30% of the population is 65 years old or even older, the highest rate in the world. And that figure is only expected to grow, as are the numbers of old people who live and die alone. The authorities are finding it increasingly difficult to track down the families of elderly people who pass away. And even when they do, the relatives sometimes refuse to collect their dead. There are currently more than 60,000 unclaimed bodies, and the government is trying to find a way to deal with them. Our correspondent in Tokyo, Shaima Khalil, spoke to my colleague, Nick Miles.
Well, I think we're seeing the results of two overriding symptoms here in Japan. One is the aging population, which shows itself in so many different facets, whether it's the millions of empty homes, for example, whether it's the problem with the workforce. And now we're seeing many, many old people who die alone and then their bodies are unclaimed. You put that together with a society that is increasingly isolated and lonely, and you get what the government is facing now, what is known as lonely deaths or unrelated bodies. And essentially, the authorities are trying to catch up with this issue, with this problem, trying to not only see a way to tackle it, but actually to find numbers. So far, the police figures show that nearly 70,000 people, so 68,000 people aged 65 and above, die alone annually. And this could be for a number of reasons. But what you're seeing is an acute problem in urban areas. So, for example, where I am in Tokyo, it's different districts because it is more isolated. It is harsher. And you get older people who live with very little contact with the outside world. And as it stands, it's the responsibility of local authorities. The current law stipulates that if a body is found, the relatives cannot be traced, or they can be traced, but they refuse to take the body. It is up to the local authorities to then cremate the body at their own discretion and then store that. But this law was put in place at a time when it was a very, very different landscape in Japan. So the local authorities are going to the government saying, look, we're being overwhelmed, we're under-resourced, you need to do something about this to help us tackle this issue.
And Shaima, briefly, this is going to cost a lot of money for these local authorities to have to track down the relatives, and if they don't claim the bodies, to deal with the dead body. I imagine people will be quite shocked that this is going on in Japan. Is there a sense of shame that this is happening?
I think so. I think that the whole society in general is waking up to the problem, is waking up to the effects of what it means to live in an aging population. And that's just one of the symptoms, especially if you're looking at something as delicate and as sensitive as a decision on what to do with someone's remains and how to get in touch with their contacts. And also, Japan is looking at ways of, well, if people are living longer and are lonelier, what do you do to keep in contact in an increasingly isolated society?
Shaima Khalil in Tokyo. Scientists here in the UK have used fluorescent dye to help them identify cancerous prostate cells during surgery that are invisible to the naked eye. Using special imaging equipment, they were able to find and remove cancer cells which might otherwise have been left in the body. Professor Freddie Hamdi is a lead author on the research.
We've developed with our engineers here in Oxford an optical platform, an imaging platform, which uses fluorescence dyes combined with a very specific marker, which will stick to the prostate cancer cells. So when we do surgery and we shine a special camera in a patient who has received an injection of this dye with the marker, molecular marker, we can see the cancer cells light up during surgery with white light.
The team at Oxford University hope the procedure, which is in early trials, could reduce the chance of the disease returning. Here's our health reporter, Aurelia Foster.
Removing a prostate does not guarantee that all the cancer is gone. Often, clusters of cells form in tissue or lymph nodes nearby, and these can be difficult to spot. In this early stage trial, the dye was injected into 23 men with the disease before their surgery. Researchers say in many of the patients, they found and removed cells that they would not have seen without this technology. They say its use could also mean less damage is done to healthy tissue and fewer side effects. Larger scale trials are now underway to test how effective this is compared with other methods.
Aurelia Foster. The sound of the national anthem, accompanied by the banging of pots and pans, has been ringing through Venezuela's jails as inmates protest against alleged human rights abuses. Many prisoners have also been staging a hunger strike in protest against the conditions that they're held in. Our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha, reports.
The Venezuelan Prison Observatory, a non-governmental organization, says prisoners are angry about conditions inside the country's overcrowded jails. They're also complaining about government's inefficiency or negligence in processing their release orders. The delays mean many prisoners have been forced to remain in jail after serving their sentences. The protest comes 6 weeks ahead of next month's elections, in which President Nicolas Maduro is seeking re-election. The opposition has accused him of being complicit with criminal gangs that effectively control life inside prisons. But last year, his government launched a major offensive against the gangs. deploying thousands of security forces in some of Venezuela's most notorious penitentiaries.
Leonardo Rocha. Malaysia is ending a blanket subsidy for diesel, with prices for the fuel expected to rise by 50%. But some groups, including farmers and fishermen, will still be able to buy cheaper fuel. Mickey Bristow reports.
Malaysia says this policy change will lead to a reduction in smuggling. Previously, subsidised diesel could be bought in Malaysia and sold for a higher price in neighbouring countries. That price differential will now close. Withdrawing the subsidy will also save the Malaysian government nearly $1 billion a year. What's more, increasing the price of diesel should cut demand for the fossil fuel, reducing air pollution and greenhouse gas emissions, although it will mean higher prices for consumers.
Mickey Bristow. South Africa has one of the most progressive constitutions in the world. Gay marriage is legal, and it's against the law to discriminate against someone because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. The only country in Africa where that's the case. Despite this, hate crimes are common. Many people who identify as LGBTQ+ fear they could be attacked or even murdered. The South African photographer Zanele Maholi, who identifies as non-binary, has won international acclaim for challenging discrimination in their homeland. They're described as a visual activist. Vincent Dowd met them in London, where an exhibition of their work has opened.
There's a special star that shines every evening in your eyes.
Zanele Maholi was born in a South African township in 1972, filmed revisiting that world for a documentary. It's clearly a place they still enjoy. But even when young, Zanele Maholi knew those origins would be left behind.
I grew up in Durban South, in Umlazi, one of the townships. I was raised by my mum, who was a domestic worker, who had to look after children from a white family. When I was young, art was not part of my career choice because I didn't have that privilege. You were either a teacher or a nurse or doing some business course. And I attended mostly township schools, and I wanted to become something or somebody in life. And photography has become that point or space in which I speak.
Just what you did before, so when you leaned into her back.
At the Tate in London, around 300 engaging and insightful portraits from a non-binary black South African are attracting media attention. They're mainly in black and white, and mostly they focus on gay and trans South African lives, a theme identified early on.
I noticed that there was a lack of our visual voices. So speaking as an insider, I took it as my responsibility to continuously document this community. There's this notion, or wrong notion, that says that to be homosexual is an African, to be queer is a sin. People are being expelled from schools. Some people are being rejected by own family members simply because of who we are.
Zanele Moholi est aujourd'hui la photographe sud-africaine la plus reconnue sur la
scène. Zanele Moholi of South Africa has been documenting queer and trans people in that country for decades.
Im Mittelpunkt der Arbeiten der südafrikanischen Fotografin und Performance Zanele Moholi, sie selbst.
Zanele Moholi has built an international reputation with thought-provoking portraits. A drag queen poses in a mini dress and red high heels. On a beach in Durban, an elegant transgender woman poses in a bikini. But there are many defiantly unglamorous pictures of gay and trans South Africans. At times, the model is the artist, in one case sporting an eye-catching headdress made of plastic and celebrating the memory of their mother.
It's called Besta. Besta is my mother's name. And it speaks on women and work. And I used here fabric and then the pegs.
These are washing pegs, like from a washing line?
Definitely. These are washing pegs from the line. Just to bring forth how we could turn little objects that could make the picture look so beautiful. It just gives that lighter feel to it.
But the exhibition at Tate Modern in London shows the artist is serious about being a visual activist, for their community.
I am fighting for the visibility and the recognition of the Black LGBTQIA+ members from South Africa or Africa or around the world. It is very important for the people to know that we exist, that there are people who identify like us who existed before, and people get to be known and most of all to be respected.
Zanelli Maholi speaking to Vincent Dowd. Let's return now to our main story. The EU elections, which have seen an overall shift to the right, including the far right. Many are asking who is voting for the right and why. Sarah Holbolt is a professor in European politics at the London School of Economics. She spoke to Sarah Montague.
What we're seeing in some countries like France and Germany is that younger voters are backing the radical right in the same number or perhaps even larger numbers than older voters. For example, in France, where the National Rally topped the poll, they had a lead candidate, a very sort of young, charismatic Bardella, and he's been very popular with young voters. And in Germany, we've also seen that the AfD, the radical right-wing AfD, that had their best electoral results in their history, coming in second, are popular amongst young voters, especially young men in Eastern Germany. So it's not just young voters, of course, who vote for these parties, but in some countries, they are a significant proportion of the electorate. But it's not everywhere. For example, the young voters in Italy are more likely to vote for the left.
The drive, wherever it is and whatever age group it is, voting right. What is driving that? Is it immigration? Is it climate? Is it cultural identity politics?
I mean, one of the key drivers is, of course, a desire for change in terms of its grievances about what, you know, people are facing in their everyday lives. This desire for change is something we often see amongst young voters. And the right, radical right is very successful in using populist rhetoric to address people's grievances about concerns they may have about cost of living, could be lack of affordable housing or high unemployment, and also linking that with the sort of cultural concerns you mentioned about immigration and how society is changing, and promising them that they will have a, you know, better future with the radical right, you know, in charge or pushing policies.
Right. So the desire for change is not a reactionary vote.
Well, it's not reactionary in the sense that they want everything to remain the same. But of course, on the cultural issue, often there might be a nostalgia for a country that is more powerful in the world, that's not changing in terms of its ethnic makeup. Because one thing the radical right does have in common across Europe is very nativist rhetoric, often wanting to reduce immigration, and even in some cases, like the German radical right, the AfD, even wanting to deport immigrants.
Is there a difference between the north and the south of Europe, with the north more likely to go left? And here we are in the UK, of course, expected to vote in a centre-left government. Poland just recently moved back centre-left. And you mentioned Scandinavia.
I think more what we're seeing is that the radical right really used to be concentrated in a few countries. And what we're seeing now, there's almost no country in Europe that doesn't have, Britain being, of course, an exception, but also not voting in these elections, but not having a radical right-wing party. So it's more kind of a uniform trend that we see these kind of populist radical right parties also now in Southern Europe, where they used to be not as powerful. So in that sense, we can't sort of see there's a north-south divide. However, there's a kind of clear geographical divides within countries. People in cities, large cities, tend to be less likely to vote for the radical right. They gain more of their votes in towns and rural areas. Another factor is education. We see that people who are higher educated, university educated, are much less likely to vote for the radical right.
Sarah Holbolt from the London School of Economics speaking to Sarah Montague. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was produced by Harry Bly and mixed by Jack Wilfan. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at Brazil's unending flood. One of its richest cities, Porto Alegre, is still struggling with floodwaters that rushed in more than a month ago. It's been a national shock. Officials are still looking for bodies and warning of the spread of disease. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.